My name is Chris. I'm the lead pastor here. Really good to see you all here today. You're here for more than just that, but what do you think? It's like kind of appealing and I don't know. This could be too tempting. I'm kind of more of a It's not bad. I like the set. So. Oh yeah, all of the children here, 11 years old and under, can head off to the classrooms now. If you weren't in the play or whatever, it doesn't really matter. You can just head off and go be with the other kids if you'd so desire. All right? All right. We are in the third week of a series, an Advent series, through the book of Ruth. I'm really glad that you're here, but you may need a little catching up because you may not get the whole story if you don't get a little bit of a review, possibly. But the book of Ruth is set in a time of about 1,000 years before the birth of Jesus. It was in a time of the judges, when there was no king, but they were all of the prophets and everything. It was just kind of a ruling through God's divine selection. And so in the time of the judges, there was chaos, and there wasn't really a lot. In fact, the Bible says that everybody kind of did what was right in their own eyes. So they just kind of did whatever. In this time, there's a situation that arose where there was a famine in the land of Judah. And a whole family up and left Judah, went into Moab where there was food. And the family was led by a man named Elimelech and his wife Naomi. They took off and they took their two sons. In the meantime, what happened was Elimelech died in the land of Moab. They lost their two sons as well. So here's a family now with, it used to be a pretty full family, looking pretty good. Everything looked pretty healthy for them. And all of a sudden, it's down to Naomi and her two daughters-in-law. And eventually, one of them leaves. And so it's just Naomi and Ruth. And so the book is titled Ruth, but it's actually could be about as much about Naomi and the other characters in here as it is about Ruth. But Ruth is a woman of excellence. She's a woman of high moral standards. She's a woman who is very devoted, committed to her mother-in-law. She had the chance to leave her mother-in-law and just carve out her own life, and she decided not to. She decided to stay with her mother-in-law, said that her life was intertwined with hers, and she said, I will be where you are, and I'm going to go where you go, and I'm going to serve the God that you serve. And actually, kind of speaks toward her conversion toward Judaism. And so there's these three main characters. There's Naomi, there's Ruth, and then there's a man named Boaz. And Boaz is a man of, again, of really high, worthy standing in the community. He has a great reputation. He's a man who is wealthy. He's a huge landowner. But he's known for more than just being wealthy. He's known for being worthy. He's also a man of just a real high moral standards. We pick up the story today in chapter 3, where there's has been an encounter, seemingly a chance encounter, but it wasn't really a chance encounter, where Ruth and Boaz kind of met. Boaz is a little bit older. He might even be old enough to be her father or maybe an uncle, something like that, but Ruth is a younger woman, probably in her mid to late 20s. Boaz probably at least 40s, possibly in his 50s. She goes to glean, trying to get some food for her impoverished mother-in-law, and meets Boaz, this wealthy guy. Boaz kind of picks up some clues, and he thinks that she's a pretty good-looking lady, and she thinks that he's could be the guy for her as well. So there's these little sparks that have flown a little bit. We pick up the story in chapter 3 and verse 1. It says, "Then Naomi, her mother-in-law, said to her, 'My daughter, should I not seek rest for you that it may be well with you? Is not Boaz our relative with you, or with whose young women you were? See, he is winnowing barley tonight at the threshing floor. Wash therefore and anoint yourself, put on your cloak, and go down to the threshing floor, but do not make yourself known to the man until he has finished eating and drinking. But when he lies down, observe the place where he lies, then go and uncover his feet and lie down, and he will tell you what to do.' And she, Ruth, replied, "All that you say I will do." It sounds like a meddling mother-in-law to me, but that's just my perspective, where she says, "Hey, Ruth, I got this plan for you. You know, this Boaz guy kind of likes you, so let's enhance the process, maybe even speed it up a little bit. Go clean up, put on some perfume, dress up really nice, and go put yourself before him and see what he thinks." And, you know, it seems more like a mother than a mother-in-law, but it could be a mother-in-law, I suppose. But Ruth says, "Yeah, I can do that." Now, there's more to it than that. There's a lot more depth of story and what all is going on. We talked first couple weeks of this series about the providence of God, the sovereignty of God, how God works behind the scenes in things that just seem very routine or very tragic even, and God works through those to bring about his perfect will. And so as we look at this story, it could be seen through the eyes of just surface of what's going on. You know, "Oh, there's a relationship forming. Isn't that cool? That's so sweet." Or we could see God is doing something. God is doing something very significant in the lives of very ordinary people. And he does this regularly throughout Scripture. We see that God uses really, really ordinary people to do extraordinary things. What God chooses to do, he does through whomever he chooses to do it. And he doesn't always use the ones that we would pick, but he uses the people who are somewhat insignificant and a lot of times just very, very plain. He decides to do that in the life of Ruth. There's a lot more going on here than meets the eye. In verse 6, we say, she went down to the threshing floor and did just as her mother-in-law had commanded her. And when Boaz had eaten and drunk and his heart was merry, he went to lie down at the end of the heap of grain. Now, there's some historical and cultural things that probably need to be explained, or else you really don't understand the significance of what's going on here. One of them is the threshing floor. The threshing floor is a place, usually it's set up on the top of a hill of some sort, because in the process of threshing or winnowing the wheat or the barley, they need wind. And so the threshing process was one that was taking place on a big, either a clay circular pad or maybe even bedrock, something that was fairly flat and fairly wide open and fairly large. And what they would do is every landowner, they'd have community threshing floors. And so every landowner in the area would bring their grain, they'd throw it on the threshing floor, and oxenites, they would wander around and they would haul a sled behind them and they would crush the whatever grain was out there. And as they crushed it, it separated the kernels, the actual grain from the chaff. We get phrases like, you know, separating the wheat from the chaff and all that out of this process. And so after the ox would crush the wheat, then they would take winnowing forks and they would throw it up in the air and let the light breeze just haul away the lighter chaff. And then the grain would fall to the ground, and then they would collect the grain. And so each landowner in process would go through the same thing, just keep going and going. And then they would gather up their grain. They would pile it in one specific location, marking, "This is my grain, this is not your grain." It was kind of a co-op, but not really, you know, fully a co-op. So they'd get to their own little spot, and that was their spot. So also, the other thing going on here is there's this word redeemer keeps popping up. He's our kinsman. He's our redeemer. And the significance of that is probably lost on us because we don't have anything close to that in our culture. In the Jewish culture of this day, the law stated that if there was a woman who was married to a guy and that guy died, the next brother in line to the guy that died was the one who would marry that woman. And if that brother was unavailable or if he had passed away, then it would go down the line to the next closest relative. Could be a cousin, could be an uncle. So there's this line of succession that would happen. And I don't know how that would work. It'd be kind of awkward, really. It's like when you're marrying somebody, you start looking at his brothers going, "Yeah, I don't know, man. Are you healthy? Have you been checked out lately?" You know, it would be a lot of concern on the women's part, I would think. Anyway, I'd just like, "Yeah, he's a loser. You're cool. He's a loser, though. I'm not marrying you." So there's this line of succession that would happen, and they would have to go right down the line. And that was important because what had happened was when Elimelech and his family took off from Judah, they sold their land. And when they sold their land, and they had nothing left there, so they moved on to Moab. But he dies there. They come back to Bethlehem where they were from, and they have no land. They have nothing. In fact, two widows living together with no land just meant impoverishment for the rest of their lives. They would be beggars. They would be gleaners. They would never have any significant provision for themselves. They'd never have any standing in the community. They would always be, oh, those two old widows who have nothing. Everybody would kind of not shun them, but it would be like, oh, you poor dear. You know, there would never be an acceptance, a full acceptance into the community. And so it was important that this Redeemer person, whoever that might be, step in to play that role. And so as we look at the story of Ruth and where we're at right now, she recognizes that Boaz is in the line of succession. She doesn't know where he is. On their first meeting, she didn't even know he was, but Naomi said, hey, Boaz, he's part of our family. He's one of Elimelech's line. And so he could be the Redeemer. And so Naomi hatches the plan and says, hey, okay, dress up, look good, go to the threshing floor, all this is happening. Once the threshing was done, they would have a party. It was just a big community party, just like the olden days when there would be barn raisings or there would be some significant event based on the harvest. And it was just another harvest party. And so the whole community would gather. There'd be a lot of partying. There'd be dancing and there'd be a lot of joy and some drinking as well. And it said that Boaz got his fill, which is a euphemism for he had a little bit to drink. And so, and then he went to bed and he just went to sleep. Well, Ruth's instructions were from Naomi that wait till he goes to sleep, and then you go and slip in at his feet under the covers. And this sounds very seductive and kind of nasty, a little salacious, but it's not. This is actually a fairly routine kind of a setup where if you were a servant or a slave of a master, being at the feet of the master just designated that you were humble and that you were at the beck and call of that master. There was nothing about it that was seductive or nothing sexual at all. It was just being at the feet of the master, waiting for the master to give a command or something. That was the humble attitude that it took to be at the feet of somebody. So it says, when Boaz had eaten and drunk and his heart was merry, he went to lie down at the end of his heap of grain. And verse 7, she came softly, uncovered his feet, and lay down. At midnight, the man was startled and turned over, and behold, a woman lay at his feet. I would think that'd be a little startling. He said, who are you? And, or maybe if he was a little more composed, who are you? I kind of go like, ah, who are you? She answered, I'm Ruth. I'm your servant. Spread your wings over your servant, for you are a redeemer. And this is, again, language that designates a whole different connotation than we might get out of in our culture. She's saying, spread your wings over me, which means a covering or a protective layer. Spread your protection over me because you're my redeemer. Now, in this culture also, what we have to understand is it was not really something that the man would initiate. To say, hey, I'm your redeemer, you're pretty hot, I want to marry you. It wouldn't go that way. It would be more like the woman's role to say, you're the redeemer, what do you think? You're a potential for me. It wasn't forward, it wasn't out of the box for a woman to do that. In fact, it was her role to say, you are my redeemer, do you want to fulfill that role for me? And so she says that. She says, you are a redeemer, spread your wings over me, essentially saying, do you want to become my protection? Will you allow me into this family that you have? Will you become the one who I look to for provision and protection and covering in my life? And the story goes on from there. There was a few rules or a few kind of principles that had to be fulfilled for a person to be a kinsman redeemer, and one of them was they had to be related by blood to those he redeemed, so that he was. He had to be able to pay the price required for redemption, which means he'd have to buy the land that Elimelech sold before he went into Moab. He'd have to be able to have the substance to be able to purchase the land. And we see that Boaz was a wealthy man, and he could actually do that as well. And number three, he had to be willing to pay the price. He, not just able, but willing. He had to say, yeah, I do want to head in that direction. And then fourthly, the kinsman redeemer had to be free himself. He couldn't be in bondage to anything or anybody as a result. So at the appropriate time, Naomi instructs Ruth to go in and say, hey, what do you think? Do you think this thing could work? Do you think we want to give this a go? Are you willing to become my redeemer? And in verse 10, we see this. He said, may you be blessed by the Lord, my daughter. You have made the last kindness greater than the first, in that you have not gone after young men, whether rich or poor. Now, we'll stop right there and just kind of talk about that just for a second. And that she had the opportunity, probably, to marry somebody younger. But what her concern really wasn't for herself as much as it was for Naomi. Remember in chapter 1, she said, where you go, I will go. Your kin will be my kin, and I will die where you die. I will be laid to rest. And her devotion was, first of all, not to her own good, but for the good of Naomi, her mother-in-law. I think that's a pretty admirable quality. She says, or he says, that you've not gone after young men, whether rich or poor. It hasn't been something on your mind to say, man, I want to take care of myself. I got to get this thing settled. He said, I'm going to take care of Naomi, and whatever that takes, that's what I'm about. And verse 11 says, and now, my daughter, do not fear. I will do for you all that you ask, for all my fellow townsmen know that you are a worthy woman. And now it is true that I am a redeemer, yet there is a redeemer nearer than I. Remain tonight, and in the morning, if he will redeem you, good, let him do it. But if he is not willing to redeem you, then as the Lord lives, I will redeem you. Lie down until the morning. So what he's saying is there's a closer relative in the line of succession. I don't have first dibs on you. There's another guy who has first dibs on you. It sounds terrible, but in our culture, we'd never understand this, but that was their culture. That's just the way it worked. And so he said, I've got to check this out because I can't just step over this guy and say, forget you, I'm going to do what I want to do. He says, I'm going to ask this other guy about the arrangements, and we'll get into that next week in chapter 4. He says, I'll check it out in the morning. You just go back to sleep now. So in verse 14, she lay at his feet until the morning, but arose before one could recognize another. And he said, let it not be known that a woman came to the threshing floor. And he said, bring the garment you are wearing and hold it out. She held it out, and he measured out 6 measures of barley and put it on her. Then she went into the city. Just a point of interest here, a measure of barley, probably talking about an ephah. And an ephah was about 10 pounds. So she's carrying 60 pounds of grain, packing that around. I thought that's a pretty stout woman. I don't know if you've been stout is, that was a positive. I wasn't saying that in a negative, okay? Oh, man, you guys are tough. But you might have even seen pictures of people carrying heavy weights on their heads like that, and just, you know, water jugs, all that kind of stuff. In Africa, when we've gone there, we see that quite often, where there's, water jugs being carried, and they probably weigh 30, 40 pounds. And so this might have been the way she was carrying that. But she's got this, her garment that she has, and she's got 60 pounds in there just packing that home. Pretty impressive. So she gets back to home, and you can just imagine, I can kind of envision what's going on in Naomi's head. She's concocted this whole plan, right? She's got this whole thing going on. It's like, okay, here's what you're going to do. You're going to go smell good. You're going to look good. You're going to lay at his feet. You're going to be so submissive. It's going to be awesome. And come on, give me the story. And so Naomi's sitting up all night. I'm taking biblical liberty there. And when she came to her mother-in-law, she said, right, how'd you fare? What happened? Come on, give me the story. Then she told her all that the man had done for her, saying, these 6 measures of barley he gave to me, for he said to me, you must not go back empty-handed to your mother-in-law. She replied, wait, my daughter, until you learn how the matter turns out, for the man will not rest, but will settle the matter today. So we see this whole thing just playing out, and it's been a long kind of drawn-out story. You see that earlier we saw that Ruth had been in the field harvesting and gleaning for the whole during the whole barley and the wheat harvest. So it was several weeks that she's been, you know, kind of around Boaz, and he's been watching, he's been figuring it out, and Naomi's kind of been in the background saying, hey, maybe this will happen, this will be awesome, and she's really excited about that. And now we see this thing's really coming to a head. We see that Boaz has made a commitment to her and said, I will spread my wings over you, my protection, my covering over you, but first I got to take care of business, and we will do that next week. We'll talk about that whole thing. But there's a lot more to the story than just the human level, all the, you know, cultural stuff that's going on. There's so many parallels in this story between what Boaz does and what Jesus has done for us. And there's so many parallels between who Ruth is and what she's doing and who we are. And as we go into that a little bit more, we see that there's this significant tie, a picture's being painted through the book of Ruth that talks about us. And talks about us in relationship to Jesus. And it talks about it in such a way that it's kind of a little bit masked, a little bit cloudy, but the picture comes clearer as you start understanding more and more about it. There's several different points of relevance for us, and I've got three, and we'll just go through those briefly and we'll be done. That's how you know the preacher's lying. The first one is that we are all, just like Ruth and Naomi, we are all in need of a redeemer. We are. These guys are poor, they're widowed, they have no standing, they have nothing of value, they have nothing to look forward to, and yet that's us. Now, we might have stuff, and we might have a bank account, and we might have a lot of things in our closet, but we're still looking for redemption. We need something more than that, and I think as we live more and we get closer toward our day, we start seeing that, yeah, stuff isn't where it's at, and you know, my experiences, and you know, it's just not where it's at. Every day that we live, we get a little bit more of a revelation that there's something in my life that's not quite right. Kids are great, I feel fine, family's wonderful, or maybe not, but we have all this stuff going on, but there's still something nagging at the back of us. There's something missing here. There's something not quite right. There's something that I need, but I'm not quite sure what that might be. And as that starts getting clearer to us that the need is there, there's some kind of a thing in us that calls out for something more significant than just the stuff and the happiness around us and all of that, that there's something deeper that our souls cry out for. We are in need of a redeemer. Sin and the fall, the constant position we find ourselves in of being lacking in something. We continually end up in a mess, and we don't know why that would be. We make mistakes and cause problems in our lives and in other people's lives, and we just don't know why that issue keeps arising. There's got to be a solution to this. Why is this the case? We're like Ruth and Naomi saying, man, we need a redeemer. We need something to get us out of this cycle that just seemingly goes downward constantly. I really believe that there's something in us that cries out for a relationship with God that is beyond our understanding or our comprehension, and we can't really articulate it, but it is there nevertheless. There's something in us, and it doesn't matter what our background is, or there's something in us that cries out for something bigger than just a solution on this human plane. There's something more than that, and we can't quite figure it out, and we look, and we strive, and we say, I know, maybe it's a better job, or a different career field, or a different person in my life, or maybe if my kids were just like this, or maybe if something were to really shake it up, and maybe if I just had more dollars in my bank account, maybe something would change in me. It doesn't. And so we bump our heads up against that wall, and we just say, man, why am I here? Why do I keep finding the limits to this life? It just doesn't fill me, and I don't know why it doesn't. It seems like it's supposed to. The promises are there. Everybody says, hey, do this and get that and do that, and it'll be good. But it doesn't work that way for us. We need a redeemer. The second thing that we see of relevance in this story for our lives is that we need, and where we find that redemption is to come to the feet of Jesus. as we come to the feet of Jesus and we come humbly and we lay ourselves down at his feet, we recognize that it's only Jesus that can do what we need to have done in our lives. There is no other answer for us. There's no other significant person that could come into our lives and fix stuff. There's no thing I could do or a endeavor I could apply myself to that was going to fill that longing in my heart for something more. The deeper needs of our lives are never filled here with stuff from here. It has to come from above. And we come to the feet of Jesus and we say, without you, I am going to be spiritually impoverished for the rest of my life. Without you, I'm going to be longing for something to fill me that I don't have the wherewithal to figure out. There's something lacking in me and I don't know what it is. I come to the feet of Jesus and say, I don't know. I don't even know if you can do this, but I'm willing to humble myself and say, I need you more than I need anything else. Would you be my redeemer? Spread your wings over me and be my protection, be my covering, be my redeemer. In Romans chapter 5, verse 19, it says, for as by one, or by the one man's of disobedience, the many were made sinners, talking about Adam, so by the one man's obedience, talking about Jesus, the many will be made righteous. We're all born into this world of sin, a life of sin, and it's not something we go around and talk about a whole lot. You know, we usually like to cover and protect that. Hey, how are you? I'm great. I'm fine. Really good. I'm awesome. How's life? Oh, it's perfect. It's great. It's not. We know that, right? Here we go. Really wonder what's going on behind the scenes in your life, man. You suck at lying. Yeah, it was really bad. We're born into this life. And we have this longing and lacking and all of that stuff, but it's caused by the sin nature that we have. And isn't this a great Christmas message? It's so good. It's just like rich. Oh, so happy. So but it's real. And that's the thing. This is the real thing that we have going on inside of us, is we have this separation from God because of sin introduced into our DNA centuries, millennia ago by the fall. And so if we're going to be welcomed into relationship with the Father, welcomed to our future heavenly home, we need to have a Redeemer. Coming to the feet of Jesus is significant in that process. Being able to come to a place of humbling ourselves, being able to come to a position of saying, I don't have what it takes to fix what's wrong with me. It's significant. And we've got to do that at some point. Just like the woman who came to Jesus, he's at a table, at a banqueting table. She comes to him, breaks a very expensive box full of very expensive perfume and pours it over him as a sign of honor and saying, you are amazing. You deserve the best of me. And then she just wept at his feet. Says that her tears wet his feet, and then she dried those dirty feet with her hair. And people around him were astonished and appalled and, oh, Jesus, if you knew what kind of woman that was, you wouldn't let her touch you. He said, you know, he told us a little parable, but he eventually came down to this. He said, those who have been forgiven much love much. And the key for us is to recognize how much we need forgiveness for and who is able to give us that forgiveness. It is only at the feet of Jesus where that happens. And this is significant for us. And so we find ourselves in this Ruth and Naomi kind of position where it's like, hey, you know, you're going to be struggling your whole life unless you come to the feet of Boaz. Well, we're coming to the feet of Jesus and saying, I don't want to live this life of impoverishment, spiritual impoverishment the rest of my life. I want to live a life that is freed up from that. I want to live a life that's full and rich and more than just in, you know, hey, get more money and get more stuff and get more experiences, and not that. It's at the feet of Jesus. All those things, they don't disappear. All our troubles don't disappear, but we do have a framework to process those through as a result. And it makes for a life that is full and rich. And that's what comes from being at the feet of Jesus. The third thing and final thing is that we're brought into the one relationship we most desperately need, and that is the relationship with the Father that comes through Jesus Christ. As a result of all that happens as we come to the feet of Jesus, spread your wings over me, you're my Redeemer, all of that, what we find is more than just provision, protection, covering, what we find is relationship with the Father, which is the one thing, I think, that is deeply ingrained in our souls that we need the very most. We need a relationship with the Father. And that comes as we come to Christ. Romans 5, verse 6 says, "For while we were still weak, at the right time, Christ died for the ungodly. For one will scarcely die for a righteous person, though perhaps for a good person one would even dare to die. But God shows his love for us in this, that while we were still sinners, Christ died for us." We were doing our own stuff. We were just kind of hanging out, doing whatever we wanted to do. While we were still sinners, Christ died for us. When you had no inkling of who he was or the significance he had in your life, when you had no idea how much he could do for you, he died for you. When you were still cursing him and living in direct opposition to him, Christ died for us. Amazing that he would do that. Who would do that? That's what it says here in Romans. It says, for one will scarcely die for a righteous person. We'd probably give up quite a bit for a good person. Oh, you're a good person, I would sacrifice for you. But for a cruddy person, I'm not giving up nothing. I don't know, just being honest. I know you're probably much more advanced and holy than me, but I'm not giving up nothing for a cruddy person. That person that cuts me off on the road, I'm not giving nothing to him except for maybe a horn honk. You know, that's a, "You're a jerk." But Jesus died for the ungodly. Jesus died for that. He died for all of the stuff that we do in opposition to him. Seeing all of that, he died for those who are crucifying him. He died for those who punished him. And if we understand the significance of his sacrifice for us, it makes our laying at his feet even that much more significant for our relationship with him. In 1 Peter chapter 1, verse 18 says, "Knowing that you were ransomed from the futile ways you inherited from your forefathers, not with perishable things such as silver or gold, but with the precious blood of Christ, like that of a lamb without blemish or spot." Referring back to the Old Testament sacrifices of taking the perfect animals out of the flock and sacrificing them for the sins that we had committed. He says, this is who Jesus was. He was the perfect, spotless one who sacrificed, his blood poured out for the sins of everyone. God so loved the world that he gave his one and only Son, that whoever should believe in him will not perish but have everlasting life, right? And this is what he did. Now, we have this great longing, we have this great need in our life, and we have one kinsman redeemer, the man Jesus Christ. He is the one who could do the work. And the biggest lesson we can get out of this whole chapter of this little insignificant, seemingly insignificant book of Ruth is that Jesus Christ is our redeemer, and we should do everything we can to put ourselves at the feet of Christ. And that's why Christmas is so significant. That's why what we're doing with, throughout, you know, these whole weeks and days that surround the holiday should always be pointing to, just like Jordan said, should always be pointing to this significant event of Christ coming. Not because it's a cute little story, a baby in a manger and all that kind of stuff, but because he's our Redeemer. It's the only way for us to have a relationship with the Father. It's the only way for us to break through, to get out of this impoverishment that we live in, to have significant, meaningful relationship with God the Father. It's through Jesus Christ. So we look forward to it. The word Advent is just a derivative of a Latin term that means to anticipate or to long for the awakening or the waiting for, this looking forward to. And as we have this season of Advent, we're looking forward to this time of Christ. We remember what the the longing of the ancient ones was looking forward to the Messiah. Now the Messiah has come, and he's going to come again. And so now we relish the past, but we look forward to the future as well, the second coming of Christ. And we long for that as well, because that has a huge bearing on everything that we do today, right? It has significance. So we have a Redeemer. He calls for us to lay it down at his feet and accept the provision as he covers us with his cloak. And I'm telling you, that's the biggest thing about Christmas. It's more than anything else that we're celebrating, is that we have a Redeemer. It's a wonderful thing. It's a wonderful thing. Father, thank you so much for your goodness to us. Thank you that you have redeemed. Father, I thank you for each person in this room who has recognized that. And for those who have not, God, I pray that you'd speak and speak clearly the significance of the work that you have done for us to conquer sin, to defeat the enemy, and to free us from this spiritual impoverishment that we've suffered through. God, continue to work in our lives. Continue to bring us to your feet as we humbly serve you. In Jesus' name, amen. Amen.